My name is Cecil Corrigal, not the Cecil that stole the jug last night, but when Jim Shaw went crazy. But I am an alcoholic. I'm from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, Canada. 26 miles west of Toronto, where I'm supposed to be flying to tomorrow, according to Charlie. And I hope that my plane doesn't take me by Toronto, because I don't want to go there. But I understand. I've been in the United States enough time to know you know absolute nothing about Canadian geography, so that's all right. I'll forgive you for that. I'm just glad to be here. I'm grateful to be anywhere, as a matter of fact. Matter of fact, if you ride from Los Angeles Airport up here with Dave in a 1973 Cadillac with no brakes, no oil, and Dave telling you his life history, you'll be grateful to be anywhere. And thank you for finding me a volunteer to drive me back, because I didn't really want to ride back with him. The last time they got a volunteer, Clancy and I were over in somewhere in Georgetown in North Dakota, and Clancy rented a car in Fargo, and we'd ridden in together to this deal, but then he had to go over to Dick's place on Saturday night. And so he left, and they got a volunteer to take me back to Fargo. And I'd only been in Georgetown once before and didn't know the place. But the two people that volunteered had just come out of a treatment center. And when we got out on the highway, they turned right, and I thought, well, gee, this is wrong. I know Clancy and I came in from this side. So I said, don't we go this way? And they said, well, we'll check with the service station. And they did, and we found out we're going the way that I was wanted to go. But that wasn't really a good trip. So I hope that the people that volunteered are just not out of treatment. And I've had a great time, and I want to thank the committee for allowing me to be here this weekend. I want to thank all the people for your hospitality, because you are a friendly bunch of people. And that's what I like to see in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've met so many people, and it's just good to see people. And I watch the committee, and other than Jim Shaw, everybody seems to be in good shape. But I can't understand why he gets so upset about that jug last night. He called it a pitcher, and I thought he said picture, and I thought he must have a gold picture of Bill Wilson or something up there. But Cecil, I'm glad you were stupid enough to put up your hand and say you had it. My God, that's the last thing I would have done. But I noticed the committee, and you're a hard-working committee, and that's really good to see, because, you know, some committees aren't like this, but it's good to see a committee really getting along. And that reminds me of a story. It doesn't really, I intended to tell it all along, but the story of a golfer that was out golfing, and he'd had a bad day, and he was sitting in the clubhouse all by himself, and he said, oh God. And a voice came down and said, yeah, what's the trouble? And he looked up and he said, that you, God? God said, yeah, that's me. What seems to be the trouble? He said, well, I just can't putt. Well, he said, tomorrow when you're out, he said, you know, keep your head down and swing the old putter like the pendulum of a clock, and everything will be all right. So while he had him on the line, he thought he should ask him something else, have a little more conversation. So he said, tell me, God, do they have a golf course up in heaven? And God said, just a second, I'll check. And he went away, and he came back, and he said, I got good news and I got bad news. First of all, for the good news, he said, they have the most beautiful golf course I've ever seen. And the golfer said, well, what can be the bad news? And he said, your tee off time is 10 after 8 tomorrow morning. So it's good to see a committee getting along with each other, because we never know when our tee off time is going to be. And it's kind of important. And first of all, I want to tell you that I've only been married once. And we do it that way in Canada. And so it kind of spoils my story, you know. We have one guy there that moved there from the United States. His name's Ernie. And he's been married 7 times. And We gave him a plaque the other day, put on his, on the back of his car, and it said, "If you haven't been married to Ernie, honk." And but you feel a little inadequate when you come down here and been married to the same lady for 49 years, and I call her my current wife just to keep her in shape. But you feel a little inadequate, when you haven't had four or five wives. It just seems that that's the way they do it in California. But I just want you to know there's something wrong with me. I'm not going to tell you a whole lot about my drinking tonight. I'm just going to tell you that I did drink. I'm not here by mistake. I did drink. I drank fast, and I drank a lot, but I didn't drink for a long time. Drank a little longer than David, and I didn't drink until I was 16 years of age. Never had a drink. I was wanted to be an athlete. I had a difficult time staying off that ball field today because I was a good ball player. And I wanted to be out there, but I didn't want to make an idiot of myself because I know I'm not a good ball player anymore. And I know some of you are going to have bad arms tomorrow, too, because I've tried that a few times. So I didn't drink, didn't smoke, but I found in his book of Alcoholics Anonymous why I drank, one of the reasons, and it says men and women drink essentially, and the doctor's opinion tells you this, because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that after a while they admit it is injurious. They cannot after time differentiate the true from false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one, and then it says they are restless, irritable, and discontented. When I was 16 years of age, I got restless, irritable, and discontented. Never had a drink. I didn't like the dis in my home. I didn't like the dis in my school. I didn't like the dis in my church. So I ran away from discipline. And to show you how swift I was in those days, I ran into the army to get away from discipline. It wasn't one of my better moves. And the first night I was in the army, I went downtown with the rest of the men, dressed in that big uniform, 16 years old. We went into a beer parlor, and I had my first drink, to my knowledge, first drink I ever had. And it was just beautiful. I could do everything I always wanted to do. All of a sudden, I was a great conversationalist. Someone said something I didn't like, and I had muscles. I told them where to head in. We went dancing after. My God, you should have seen. Now it's Canada's own Fred Astaire. For the benefit of some of you young people, he was a good dancer. And then I took a girl home, and I was Charles Boyer, and I was Clark Gable, and all of the great lovers of those days. But the next morning, I woke up just the same scared little boy that had arrived to join the army the day before. But every night, I could be what I wanted to be. And I did very well in the army. I became an instructor at 16, but unfortunately, I got kicked out when I was 17. I went back home, and by this time, I was an experienced drinker. I could drink with the best of them. And I was a trick drinker. Drink, I inhaled, and I'd take a glass and just do that, and it was gone. And someone would say, "Try that again," and gladly, as long as they were buying. And I always had to go. I was just going to the next beer parlor to put on my little act. And I did things like picking beer up the glass under my chin, a glass on top of a glass, and put up one and grab the other in my teeth and drink it. And I was, as I say, a trick drinker. And I just did this for all of the... Just went from beer parlor to beer parlor doing this. Walk in, say hi. Didn't have to pay for a whole lot of it. Got myself in a lot of trouble drinking financially. And when I was 17, still 17, I got restless, irritable, and discontented in a job I had in an aircraft factory. And I got restless, irritable, and discontented again, and I ran from that. Because I know now I didn't like responsibility. And I got a little bit of responsibility and didn't like it, so I ran. Ran back into the army. Told them I'd never been in before. This time I was a real genius. They made me an instructor immediately. They recommended me for my commission. And I'd love to stand here and tell you I was an officer in the Canadian Army. But I got kicked out when I was 18. And I went back home. And I got a job in a newspaper selling advertising. Did very well. But once again, I got responsibility. And I didn't know it then, but I know it now. I didn't like responsibility. And so I ran once again. I got restless, irritable, and discontented with this job, and I ran into the Navy. And I told them I'd never been in the service before, and this time I was a real genius. They sent me away to officer's training. And I'd love to stand here and tell you I was an officer in the Canadian Navy, but I got kicked out of officer's training. Seems that an officer didn't appreciate me telling him what to do with his ship. And I look at some of those ships now when I'm privileged to be at the East Coast or the West Coast, and it was a physical impossibility to do with his ship what I told him to do with his ship. But I didn't get kicked out of the Navy. I just got kicked out of officer's training. And I became a gunner in a merchant ship, and I sailed all over the world, and I drank all over the world. I didn't think there was anything wrong with it. I got married to that little girl that I just told you about in 1943. And she's still living in that same house as I am. And as I said, I call her my current wife. And I'd like to tell you that I was a good husband and a good father, but I wasn't. I was an alcoholic father and an alcoholic husband, didn't even know it. Because you see, in those days, everybody was drinking. It was a way of life. And I just was proud of the fact that I had a big capacity. And I had a big capacity, believe me. I could drink, and as I say, a trick drinker, and I didn't care what the brand was. I wasn't one of these that says I drank a certain brand. I didn't. I just drank whatever was available. And when the war was over, I went home like most people did. But I didn't do as most people did. Most people set out, get a job, and keep a job. Jobs were scarce because there were a lot of people who wanted the same job. We all came back at the same time. And I started getting jobs, and I started losing them. And I could get another one, and it didn't seem like there was anything wrong with it. I know now that there was, because I was celebrating the end of the war. And I think I celebrated the beginning of the Korean War and almost celebrated the end of that. And I looked around, and all of my friends that got a job when they came back had that same job, and I'd had several jobs. And I always had a job, but I didn't keep them because of my drinking. And I became a fighter. The last 2 years of my drinking, I had 17 fights and 17 knockouts, and I lost them all. I wasn't fighting in any bars. I wasn't fighting in any rings. I was fighting in bars, and I wasn't a good fighter. I just had a big mouth and got myself in a lot of trouble. That's why I tell you that, because that's part of my story of how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned how to gamble when I was in the service. I learned how to cheat a little bit when I was in the service. And I tell you that, too, because when I came back, I still continued to gamble. And one night I was at a stag for our hockey club. And I got drunk, and I got into the poker game. And I did an unforgivable thing. I got caught cheating. I guess it's okay to cheat, but don't get caught. Especially by the guy that caught me. He was a big man. He'd been a commando in the Canadian Army. And he and I had a fight, or I should say he had a fight. He hit me and I hit the cement floor, and I got up and he hit me and I hit the cement floor, and we did that a whole bunch of times. And finally I just stayed down because I couldn't get up. And they took me to hospital. And they put me in hospital, and funny thing, I was there for 5 days and nobody came to see me. I'd like to think they didn't know I was there. But I'm sure that several people knew I was there because they saw me go, but they didn't come to see me, and I guess they just didn't care. But I had a little doctor friend that was visiting me every day, and I'd been in the service with him, and thank God for that. And the day before I was getting out, he sat down on my bed, and he said, "Cease, I've done everything I can do for you." He said, "The rest is up to you." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, I was in the service with you. and you should have had your commission, but you didn't because you were drinking. And he said, things haven't improved since you got home. And he said, I think you're an alcoholic. And I said, well, what should I do about it? And he said, well, I think you should join Alcoholics Anonymous. And he left it at that. Thank God he didn't leave it at that when he went out, because that night he sent a couple of people to see me. Uninvited, they just came to see me. And you know, sometimes when I hear people say that they get a phone call from somebody, would you go and see somebody? And they say, well, do they want help? And they say, well, they haven't asked for it. And we say, well, we don't know. I wonder what would have happened if Bill Wilson, when he called Dr. Bob, you know, if he hadn't called him. I don't think Bob was sitting there waiting for Bill Wilson's call. And I think that the fact that these two people came to see me uninvited to tell me about Alcoholics Anonymous was probably the greatest thing that's ever happened to me in my life. And they came and they told me about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I do both of them. I come from a town of 35, 36,000 people. At that time, it was about 20,000. I knew both of these people. I drank with both of them. And here they are to see me and to tell me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And they talked loud, and I tried to change the subject, and they didn't change the subject. They just told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And they got a commitment out of me that they would see me the next morning. I was getting out of hospital, and they'd see me. They had an emergency meeting, and I had to be out at 10 o'clock. In those days, there were 15 people who belonged to Alcoholics Anonymous in my city. And that morning, they all came. Because in those days, when you got a live one, they all came. And so we weren't getting them by the busloads in those days. But I know why I became an alcoholic. I became an alcoholic because I'm a Protestant. Don't laugh, you Catholics. I grew up in a Catholic community, one of the only Protestants that were there. And I grew up hating Catholics because they treated me bad. They called the bingos in Latin so that I couldn't understand them, and they did bad things to me. And here I am in a Catholic hospital with a bad check for a private room because it was before the days of Medicare. And this little nun couldn't seem to find a place to cash this check, and she was very unhappy about it. And next morning I phoned the only person in the world that my credit was any good with, and that was the bootlegger, my bootlegger. And he came to get me out of hospital, take me to this meeting and pay my bad check. And took me down to this meeting. And I'll never forget that morning. My shirt was all torn, it was covered with blood, and my suit jacket was torn from this fight I'd been in. And I had my overcoat on, and I was trying to keep my collar up so that people wouldn't see. And I have always liked nice clothes, still nice, like nice clothes. But now I pay for them. That morning, my clothes didn't look that great. But the guys came in, and they all made smart remarks, you know, Happy New Year, and we've been waiting for you, and we've got a chair for you, and all those things that I didn't really understand that I use today, but I didn't know what they were talking about. And I liked every one of them, and I knew everyone. And I liked what they said. And then they said, well, we'll take you home. And I said, no, 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 I don't want that. I'll go home by myself. Because I'd been away a few other times for 3 or 4 days, and my wife was very narrow about that. And she always, people would come home with me, and she'd run them off. And so I didn't want my newfound friends to take me home. Fortunately, that was... not fortunately that there was no Al-Anon, but in those days there wasn't any Al-Anon in our city. But some of the ladies whose husbands were in AA had gone up to tell Babe what I was trying to do. And I can remember walking into that house that cold morning. And she opened the door and she kissed me. And she said, I think everything is going to be okay, hon. If nothing else, I stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous for that day because of that, because she had changed already. You know, I mean, that was just beautiful. Hugging me, kissing me, and this just wasn't the reception she usually gave me. And we went to the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. It was Saturday night. And I will never forget that night because it was January 16th, 1952. I was 27 years old, and I went up there, and there were a whole bunch of old people, 45, 50 years old. My God, I thought, what have I got into? And then they started to play games. They had a social before the meeting, and I can remember them playing Pin the Tail on the Donkey. And that really wasn't my idea of a Saturday night, I'll tell you. I mean, you know, and then I looked around, and everybody was having a good time, including my wife. Except me. And finally I joined into the fun. And then they had a meeting. And a guy stood up and said he was sober for a year. And I sat in the back in my big negative way and thought, well, liar, you know, can't be much of a drunk if you can stay sober for a year. But I knew this guy, and I knew he just wasn't sober all the time. I just knew he was a traveling man. He went out on the road and drank and come back and told his donkeys he was sober, you know. And they had a pretty good meeting, and then they took me in another room. A couple of the old-timers were sober about 18 months, and they took me in the other room and told me that in those days they used to say there's no musts in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, you heard tonight that there's no musts in AA, but they said tomorrow morning there's a meeting here, and you must be here. And I'm glad they talked to me like that, because that's the only language I knew, and that's the language that kept me coming back. And I have never, ever missed meetings. They told me, that little guy told me that night, the guy by the name of Bobby Motherwell, who's gone to that great round above top, and he said, Cease, make a decision tonight. We have two meetings a week in this group. It's the only group they had there then. He said, make a decision that you're going to come to both meetings. Make a decision right now. You're going to go to two meetings a week. And then that way you won't have to make a decision each meeting. And that's what I did. And so I'm very grateful Bobby told me that. Bobby told me something else that night, and I want to share it with you. He said, put his arm around me, he said, we want you and we need you and we love you. I didn't think anybody wanted me. I didn't think anybody needed me. And Babe had informed me that nobody loved me. And so here's a guy telling me, and I like that. And I didn't want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was something like the three alcoholic rabbits. I don't know whether you have any alcoholic rabbits down here, but we have them back home. They sit out by the fence and their ears drooping down. And there were three of them. And they were called Foot and Foot Foot and Foot Foot Foot. And Foot Foot used to phone them Foot Foot Foot. And he'd say, let's pick up old Foot and we'll go down to the bar. So Foot 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 pick up old Foot and they'd go down to the bar. One night Foot Foot was sitting talking to Foot 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 and Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, he said, where's Foot? And Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, he said, well, he's here just a minute. We went outside. So Foot Foot and Foot Foot Foot, they went outside, found poor old Foot Foot's dead. So Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, he said, what do you think we should do with Foot? And Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, he said, well, I think we should take him down to the funeral home. After the funeral, Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, he said, well, I think old Foot died from him. Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, he said, well, I think he was alcoholic. And Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, he said, well, do you think we're alcoholic? And Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, he said, we're drinking quite a bit. And Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, he said, do you think we should join Alcoholics Anonymous? And Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, might as well, he said, we got one foot in the grave anyway. And that's what I thought about Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, yeah, I'd have one foot in the grave. And I got really active into Alcoholics Anonymous right away, and they took me everywhere, and they patted me on the back, and I stayed sober just by pats on the back. And it was really great. We went to deals not nearly as big as this, but we went to little deals and all over the country, and I was the youngest member in the whole province of Saskatchewan. And incidentally, that province of Saskatchewan is about three times the size of Texas. Just thought I'd throw that in for the benefit of the Texans that are here. And it's big country. But we went to roundups and we went to meetings and we just went all over the place. And I was just loved it because everybody was just patting me on the back saying, you're doing a fine job, son. You know, and I know it's no big deal to come to weigh 827 today, but back in 1952 it was. There just weren't any young ones around. And then a horrible thing happened. Some younger members came in. And they walked right by me and talked to the older members, and the older members walked right by and talked to the younger members, and all of a sudden I'd become a middle member. Now, I don't care whether you're an Al-Anon, an Alateen, or Alcoholics Anonymous. One day you're going to become a middle member. And it's bad. You know? You're just like a hole in a donut. You're nothing. Just nothing. People walk right by you. And I thought, well, maybe if I go out and drink a little bit and come back in, I'll get the same treatment as I did before. But thank God I didn't have to do that. Because we had a fellow in our group named Ernie Sear, and we asked Ernie to chair the meetings for 3 months, and back home we have discussion meetings. And Ernie said he would chair the meeting for 6 months, providing we did one thing. And we said, what's that? And he says, providing we go through the steps as a group, we don't study them, we do them. And he said, there's a difference between studying them and doing them. And we thought we'd, you know, humor old Ernie, so we did that. And that's what I want to share with you tonight. The things that happened to me since I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember we went to that first meeting, told us to bring our big books, told us about the first 57 pages of the big book, and sent us home to read it. And it's not easy when you're new in AA to read the first 57 pages and to know what, and think, well, maybe he's going to ask you some questions about it. And because I had sort of spot read the big book, I hadn't read it, you know, but I just spot read it. And I know none of you down here do that. I know you've all read it to its complete. And, but back there, that's where I did. And we went back to that first meeting, and then Ernie said, okay, said, how many's read the first 57 pages? We all put up our hands, all 16 of us. And he said, okay, now we're going to take the first step. We're going to do it. Well, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, and our lives have become unmanageable. I didn't even know there was a second part to the first step till that night. I was powerless over alcohol, but I never thought of the unmanageability of my life. And so Ernie started talking about the unmanageability of lives. And I found out that I had an unmanageable life as far as money is concerned. Now, I'm going to share some things with you that when I look at the cars and the different things that happened down here, I know you wouldn't have a clue what I'm talking about. I'm talking about financial difficulties. And I had them. I came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came here owing $6,200. I came here by way of a poker game, so I didn't owe it for anything. I just owed it. And I owed some of it to strange people. And my boss, I had a good job. My boss got sick and tired of getting phone calls and me getting phone calls. And he took me to the bank, endorsed my note for $6,200. He and the bank manager sent the money off to the people that I owed money to. Made Babe and I sign a piece of paper that we would always pay cash for everything. 3 years later, he had to bail me out for $7,500 because I had a problem as far as money was concerned. Now, as I say, I know you don't know what I'm talking about, but maybe someday you'll sponsor somebody and they got some financial problems. And you'll say, by God, we heard a guy from Canada talking about that. You know, maybe get a hold of his tape and we'll listen to it. And I'll tell you, financial problems are a bad thing. Get you in a lot of trouble. You see, I didn't stop gambling when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just thought I'd be a better gambler. Golly, those ponies don't run any differently. You can lose money sober. I found that out. And then I found out that financial problems had nothing to do with money. But I found out financial problems had something to do with big shot-ism. Something to do with pride, something to do with ego. I was the kind of a guy that I walked in to buy something and they'd say, well, it's $369. I would say, well, do you have something for about $700, you know? And I didn't have a down payment for the $369. But I had big shot-ism. I had too much pride to tell somebody that I could only afford to give them part of what I owed them. And that's a bad way. And I had an ego that was really, really, really bad. And I can remember going home one day. I'll tell you what financial problems can do you. I went home one day, and this time, that sweet little wife of mine had gone to Al-Anon. Al-Anon had started. And we're sitting there at lunchtime, sitting with our two little daughters, and By this time, I'd become an eye specialist. You know, I can do this, I know this more than anybody else does. I, you know. And Babe said to me, I thought you said you paid so-and-so. And I said, if I said I paid him, you know. She said, why would they phone me this morning and tell me you haven't paid him? And you know what the good member of Alcoholics Anonymous did? Took my food, plate, everything, threw it into the sink, right over my wife's head, broke the plate, got up, removed the phone from the wall, and said, they'll not be phoning you anymore. And went in the front room and sulked, you know. Now, this is sober. You're talking about an unmanageable life, you know. People think, well, I mean, anybody that drank that flip that I drank would have an unmanageable life. The finest old Presbyterian lady could do it, and she'd have an unmanageable life. But I'm talking about sober, talking about sobriety, what I thought was good sobriety. To show you that I've changed a little bit. Several years ago, I owed a company $10,000. That's not a lot of money in my business because I'm in the fur coat business. But it's a lot of money in the middle of July when it's about 97 above. And you're not selling any fur coats. And this guy was phoning me, writing me letters, saying bad things to me, and finally I wrote him a letter. And I told him I'd like to have fall dating on his merchandise. I said I'd sold some with small deposits. And then I threw a little philosophy at him. I said if I had 10 miles to walk on a railroad track, it'd take a long time. But if I took a telephone pole at a time, it seemed like a long ways, but I'd finally get there. And I signed it, yours truly, Cecil E. Corgill, manager, C. Corgill Furs and Fashions. P.S. I'm enclosing a certified check for $100. 4 or 5 days later, that's when the post office was operating properly, I got a letter back, and he suggested, he complimented me on my letter writing ability, suggested I get out of the fur business and go write letters for somebody. Signed it, yours truly, Mo Amsel from Amsel and Amsel in Montreal. P.S. Would you mind sending me another telephone pole? And I've sent him a lot of telephone poles. I probably owe him some right now, but it doesn't matter. Because I learned how to handle financial problems, and that was by telephone poles. And then we went on to that second good step. I had other problems as far as, you know, an unmanageability in my life, but this one was the basic one that was causing me all the problems. We went on to that second step where it said, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore me to sanity. I went to the fellows that were older in AA than I was, and I said, look, I have never been to a insane asylum. Then they didn't have treatment centers. So I said, obviously, if you're going to be restored to sanity, you must figure I'm insane. How can I come back from somewhere I've never been? And they said, Cease, that's not what it means. It means that you have a negative attitude. And so I did. I had a real bad negative attitude. I was one of those guys that, and I know once again this doesn't happen down here, where people sit around at a table trying to help somebody that's not there. You know, and they say things like, I heard, did you know? Oh, isn't it awful, you know? And I was that kind of a guy. I could just sit around talking about you or talking about the weather or talking about anything was negative. And I was just a negative thinker. I was something like a negative barber. Guy went in a barber chair one day and he said, like a haircut lasts me 3 weeks. Barber said, why 3 weeks? And he said, I'm going on vacation. Barber said, where are you going? And he said, well, first of all, I'm going to London, England. Barber says, you're not going to London, England. He says, I am. He said, you're not. He said, I am. Said, we would go there if I were you. No, he said, I've never been there. He said, but I heard that there's too many people there, too many cars. The guy said, look, I just cut my hair. If I don't like it there, I'm going to Paris. Barber says, you're not going to Paris. He said, I am. He said, you're not. He said, I am. He said, I wouldn't go there if I were you. He said, I understand. No, he said, I don't know. Never been there. He said, but I heard they really fleece the tourists. He said, the guy said, I don't care. If I don't like it there, I'm going to Rome. The barber says, you're not going to Rome. He said, I am. He said, you're not. He said, I am. Said, we wouldn't go there if I were you. He said, a lot of Catholics over there. The guy said, look, I don't care, I'm a Catholic. Yeah, but the guy said, I heard different kind of a Catholic over there. 3 weeks later, the guy come back, slid into the barber chair. The barber said, how was your trip? He said, it was good. He said, it wasn't. He said, it was. He said, you didn't go to London. He said, I did. He said, you didn't. He said, I did. He said, as a matter of fact, the lad stayed there longer, but wanted to get on to Paris. He said, she didn't go to Paris. He said, I did. He said, she didn't. He said, I did. And he said, love to stay there long, but we want to get out of Rome. He says, you didn't go to Rome. He says, I did. He says, I did. He says, I did. And he says, as a matter of fact, he said, I've got an audience of the Pope. And he says, you didn't. He says, I did. He says, you didn't. And he said, you'll never believe what happened. He says, I bent down, knelt down, bent down to kiss the Pope's ring, and you'll never believe what the Pope said. And the barber says, what? And he says, where in the heck did you get that lousy haircut? And you see, I was something like a negative barber. I didn't know, but I'd heard, you know? And something great happened to me when I was taking that second step. I was playing ball, and we'd won a provincial final, and we were down in the Army Navy Veterans of Canada, and we were celebrating the win. And my brother-in-law, who was also playing ball with me, he came over and he said, old Van wants to talk to you. Old Van was a guy that about 65 years old, that hung around the Army Navy Veterans of Canada and drank a lot of wine, and he wanted to know how I quit drinking. And I said, I quit drinking through Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, well, tell me about it. So I got old Van out of that place, and I took old Van home. Van had been drinking wine so long that he couldn't sit down, he couldn't lie down. And I walked all night with old Van up at his apartment. And I told him what the people had told me. I told him some of the things I didn't even believe myself. But I kept talking to him, and I kept talking to him. Finally, probably 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, dear old Van got feeling a little bit better, listening to me, what I was telling him, and some of the things I didn't even know. I told him about a power greater than myself. I told him I think that power is God. And I said, I asked that power for help in the morning and at night. And Van said he thought he could do that. And dear old Van got sober. Van died when he was 85 years old, but he died sober. By me telling him about a program that I didn't even know whether I believed in myself. And I started to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity because I had the opportunity to talk to Van. And we went on to that third step where it said we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. As we understood Him, many, many people say as we understand Him. It says in the book, as we understood Him. There's a difference between understood and understand. I'm not going to tell you what it is. I'll let you figure it out for yourselves. But I came to that step, and, you know, I was confused about it, but Ernie and the rest of the guys, we all discussed it together, and we wanted to take the steps, and we wanted to do them. And we figured it out that all they're asking us to do was to make a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God as we understood Him. And I don't know about you people, I think that most people don't want to make a decision because they're afraid of making the wrong decision. And I'm not great at making decisions yet. Before coming up here tonight, I was trying to decide whether I should go to the bathroom or not. And right now, I don't know whether I've made the right decision or not. But you see, we don't know whether we're going to make the wrong decision, and indecision is a killer in Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon-Alateen because we're afraid of making the wrong decision. But that's all they asked us to do in step three, was make the decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it. And I made that decision. I went downstairs one night, and I had a little chat with God. I said, look at God, I've done a bad job managing my life. How about you taking over? I'm giving her to you. And by golly, it worked. And it really worked. So you see, I had an unmanageable life. I found a manager in step two. Step three, I turned my will and my life over to the care of this manager. I kept it that simple. And I had to keep it simple because I find out that if I don't keep things simple, I will probably have trouble. Recently, my group has asked me to write a book. And I wrote, took me almost 40 years. I call it my daily spiritual guide. This is not conference approved yet, but it's a book. In front of it says, daily spiritual guide. And this is how simple I have to keep things. It says, get up and pray. Next page says, get dressed. Next page says, don't drink and go to meetings. Next page says, do the steps in sequence. Next page says, get a job. Next page says, help someone else. And the last page says, pray and go to bed. And that's about as simple I had to keep it. And I had to keep things really simple of everything I did. I have a friend of mine who has a ranch. And another friend says, how did you get the name of your ranch? And he said, well, I wanted to call it the Bar Q. My wife wanted to call it the Susie Q. My son wanted to call it the Bar Susie Q. And my daughter wanted to call it Susie Bar Q. So we called it the Bar Q, Susie Q, Susie Bar Q, Bar Susie Q. And the guy said, that's a nice name, but where are the cattle? And he said, none of them ever survived the branding, you know. So I think that's why it's important that we keep things, you know, simple. We may not survive the branding. And I did that step three, and we all did the step three, the entire bunch of it. We didn't study it, we did it. And we all turned our will and our lives over the care of God as we understood Him. We made that decision. Next week, Ernie brought pencils and paper for every one of us. And he said, tonight we're going to do step four. And he said, I bring you the pencils and the paper because he said, somebody said one day they couldn't find a pencil and a paper and that's why they hadn't done step four. And so he eliminated that excuse. And then he took this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and he turned to page 65 and he told us exactly what to do. The chart was there and he said, just do it by the chart. He says, no big deal. And so we did it by the chart. Now, there's lots of books out how to do step four. There's lots of ways, but this seemed a pretty simple way to me. And so I did my step four. And I remember phoning Elmer, my sponsor, and my sponsor is sober 10 days longer than me. And I'm the only guy that I know that's had the same sponsor for 40 years. And Elmer, he was an old-timer, sober 10 days when I come in, and I asked him to be my sponsor. And he's a great guy. His sponsor died many years after he came in, and Elmer asked me to be his sponsor, so we sponsor each other. But Elmer and I, we'd phone each other, and we'd say, how are we coming with that step four? And I'd say, I'm doing my writing. And I was doing my writing, and I was marking her down the way it was. And I had a dear old friend that used to come and visit me all the time. He was sober for about 5 years. His name was Joe DeGagne. He's now gone to that great roundup. Joe sold Catholic literature. And I didn't like his job, but I liked his AA. He was a great, great fellow. And he came up to have dinner with Babe and I that night, and I was telling him that I was doing my step four. And he said, how you making out? And I said, doesn't look too good. And he said, well, he said, find out some good things about yourself. He said, today I was in that store you work at. And he said, it looks like you have a good job. Mark it down. He said, I walked down the street. It looks like you're well thought of in the community. Mark it down. He said, I came home with you. It looks like you're driving a nice automobile. It belongs to the company. Mark it down. He says, I had dinner at your place tonight. Nice wife. Two nice girls. Nice home. He said, mark it down. And so I did all that. He said, you take an inventory of the good and the bad. And we all did our inventory. And we went back the next week. And God, I even wanted to show it to Ernie. And Ernie said, no, there's a personal thing. And we went on to that step five, where it says that we had to, you know, admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. A lot of people say, I went to another human being and did my step five. That's not what it says. It says, admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. And, you know, I went home that night, and I got down on my knees in the bathroom, because I wasn't getting down on my knees in front of babies yet, and God, I got up and looked in the mirror to admit it to myself, and you know, I changed stories from there to there. I was capable of doing that, and I know none of you people would be, but I was. And I had to do that a couple of times to get the story straight. And then I went to talk to another human being, and I went to a minister. And I tell you why I went to a minister. Because it tells me in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, on page 74, it says, now I know many of you people say you take your fifth step with your sponsor. Now, I wouldn't take a fifth step with old Elmer. Hell, he's a blabbermouth. And he's only been sober 40 years, and he may get drunk and go and tell somebody, you know. And it says on page 74, it says, rightly and naturally, we think well before we choose the person or persons with whom to take the intimate, confidential steps. Those of us belonging to a religious denomination which require confession must, and of course, will want to go to the properly appointed authority, whose duty it is to receive it. Though we have no religious connection, we may still do well to talk with someone ordained by an established religion. We often find such a person quick to see and understand our problems. And that's what says in this book. Now, please don't think that this is some Canadian propaganda. I bought my big book in the United States. And I want to thank you people for sharing it with us in Canada. That's what told me to do. At our group, we go to experienced people who are experienced with taking step fives. Now, I know there's a lot of people who've taken a lot of step fives, and they may figure themselves experienced. But I do believe that somebody that is an experienced, and it mentions a man of the cloth, probably will do a better job. It's only my own opinion, but I got out of the book. So I thought I'd share it with you. A book that I bought in the United States. So if it's wrong, you're wrong. You know? But I did my step five with this little preacher, and he knew what to do. He says, now do you know what to do, Cease? And I took my step five. And I said, what should I do? And he said, well, it tells you in the book what to do. I said, oh yeah, I know that. I said, you go to a quiet place and read step six and seven. And you know, a lot of people, because it's just two paragraphs, they sort of think that there's really nothing to do. See, step six says we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And then it says humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. I've seen people sit around meetings, myself included in them, talking about what the difference of shortcomings and defects of character are. Leave a couple hours later not knowing what the difference are and still have them and not know how to get rid of them. But it says in the sixth step that when we finish step five there, it says we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. You see, we haven't really done anything. Everybody puts so much emphasis on step four and five that all we've done is admitted we're powerless over alcohol, we have an unmanageable life, can't believe in a power greater than ourselves, could restore us to sanity, made that decision. Then we took that, you know, went and took the inventory of ourselves, went and talked to another human being, talked to ourselves, talked to God, and now are we ready to do something about it? That's what asks us. Are we entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character? Says in the 12 by 12, this is the step that separates the men from the boys. And I find out that there's a lot of people who are afraid of becoming too good too fast. Don't worry about that. Don't really worry about that. I'm privileged to be doing something like this almost every weekend. And I haven't met any saints as yet. Not even in Al-Anon of Hanoi, I haven't met any. You know, just aren't any out there. So just be entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character and humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Some people say, well, what's the difference? I believe, now this is just what I think. I think that we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. I believe that defects of character is doing something that we shouldn't do. I believe shortcomings is not doing something that we should do. You know, little things, like opening the door of the car to let that fine lady in, saying please and thank you. The little things that our grandmothers taught us. I believe that's what that's all about. It talks about humility in step seven. Step seven is a serious step. I couldn't get down on my knees. And I knew that if I was going to have any humility at all in step seven, I was going to have to get down on my knees. And I met a friend in New York. friend of Tom and I. Shy's now gone to that great roundup up above. His name was Shy Walker. Shy told the story how about he came out of prison. And he told how he couldn't get down on his knees. And one day, he was working on a construction work or something, and he had high-top boots. And he come home at night, and he kicked his high-top boots under the bed, and the next morning he got down on his knees to get his high-top boots, and he thought, by golly, I'm going to say a few words while I'm down here, you know. And he used to do that every night, boot his boots under the bed, so the next morning he'd get down there to get them and have say a few words. I don't know whether it works with high-top boots, because I didn't have any then. But I know it works with ordinary shoes, because I tried it. I don't have to do that anymore. I can pray wherever I am, whenever I want it. And I'm probably one of the prayerless members of Alcoholics Anonymous because I have so much to pray about. And I believe if there's any definition of humility, and I stole this from Arbutus, a beautiful Al-Anon lady, and she said, humility is the ability to stand up for what you believe in, and kneel down and thank God for what you have. And I believe that. Step 8, which is a beautiful step and sometimes overlooked, where we have to make the next list of all the people we've harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And I believe that step 6, 7, 8, and 9 are steps that are just missed by a lot of people. And I believe that's why there's a lot of problems in Alcoholics Anonymous where people are going away and people are leaving. You know, we got no trouble getting people here anymore. We're having trouble keeping them. And I believe that 6, 7, 8, and 9 are steps that are just not done enough. Where we make the list of all the people we've harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And in step 9, where we go ahead and make those amends. And receive those beautiful promises that it talks about on page 83 and 84, where those 12 promises, and it says right there that we're entitled to them. And I would suggest if anybody hasn't done the steps, and I don't mean study the steps, I mean if you haven't done them, do them. Don't chip yourselves. Get what's coming to you. I mean, as drunks we all, and as Al-Anons, we all wanted everything that was coming to us. Let's do it in this beautiful program that we've got. I'll give you an absolute guarantee that you can have every one of those promises that they talk about in page 83 and 84. I know because I received every one of them by doing those steps in sequence. Step 10 is such a beautiful step, where it says, we continue to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. I'm not the swiftest guy in the world, but continue to me means keep doing it. That makes sense? Huh? Is that right, Sean? Good, another Canadian agreed with me. And, you know, every night when I go to bed, I say my prayers and I have a look at my day. And I say a little prayer that I want to share with you that I learned from a grandmother. And it says, please God, treat me tomorrow like I treated people today. And be careful when you say that one. And you see, I can talk about step 10 because when I was sober 10 years, I forgot who I was and what I was and where I came from. And I was Mr. Big Shot. I had been a delegate. I was Mr. AA, and I was Mr. Central Avenue Big Shot in the city I was living in. I had a big job. I was managing the largest ladies' wear store in the province of Saskatchewan. I was looking after the furs in 5 stores, and I was great. Man, a company car and expenses, and whew. I would never missed any meetings. Went to the meetings with an attitude something like this. You lucky people, here I am. You know, someone wants me to counsel maybe for 2 or 3 minutes, I might give you some time. Drove out to the penitentiary every Tuesday night to talk to the boys at the pen, my big car, and thinking like this. Boy, they're sure lucky to have the great one coming out here every Tuesday. You know, drive back and go to my meetings, all dressed up and looking good. And one day, my boss called me in the office. And it seemed that the store wasn't quite big enough for the two of us. And it seemed that he owned the store and he wasn't about to leave. and he fired the great one after 10 years. And I walked out of that store with an attitude something like this. It won't last long now. The great one's gone. I want you to know they're still okay. They're still millionaires. They're doing all right. I had a little cousin that came to visit me about that time. She was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous from Vancouver, British Columbia. And I was going to a roundup with a dear old fellow that Tom and I both knew. His name was Dave Murray. Fine old fellow. He's now in that big roundup up there. Dave picked me up, and I'd bought some new threads, and I went down to see my little cousin Fern. Dave come in with me, and I stood up in front of her in my big egotistical way, and I said, "Well, kid, how do I look?" And Fern said these few simple words. I'm going to share them with you because it meant a lot to me. She said, "You look real good on the outside, Cease. How are you really on the inside?" And I drove to that roundup with Dave about 250 miles. Old Dave didn't talk because he thought maybe something was happening to Cease to bring me back. Never been away to bring me back. It may not make sense to me. But what I'm saying is I didn't miss meetings. I just went there with the wrong attitude. I went into Winnipeg, Manitoba. I spent a couple of days in a hotel room with a big book and talking to God. And I went back home and I went in business for myself. That's no big deal. I had to do something. But I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Never been away, but I went back. I went back with the proper attitude because that little gal said to me, "You look real good on the outside, Cease. How are you really on the inside?" And I was lousy on the inside with 10 years sobriety. And I decided that was never, ever going to happen to me again. And each and every day, I do a step 10, believe me. And it works. Step 11 said, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. I don't care where I am. Each and every morning, I get down on my knees and I have some prayer and meditation. And I read page 86 and 87 and 88. And I read the prayer on page 63 and the prayer on page 76. I read the promises. And I read the acceptance paragraph on page 449. Now I know a lot of you people in California have read the acceptance bit because it's written by Paul from California. But if you read it all, have you gone beyond just that paragraph when he talks about he and Max and that relationship? A fabulous bit of stuff in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I read things like Emmett Fox and Vincent Peale. I may read the Bible. I know it's not conference-approved literature, but I'll take a chance on it, you know. And I have my prayer and meditation. And I want to tell you why I do it. I do it because I know you never know who's out there to get you. I was going to work one morning, and I started having an argument with a guy that I was going to meet at a fur show. And I'd had an argument on the telephone. And I got getting ready for the argument that I knew I was going to have in Montreal, 2,000 miles away. And I started to argue out loud. And I'm driving to work. And I'd stop, and coming from a small town, most people know you. And I would just come to a stop sign. I'd just be giving it to this guy. And it's hard to do because you got to figure out what he's saying. He's not there. I got to my store, and I wasn't finished the argument. I drove around the block a couple of times. I had some more things to tell him. Got to my store at 8:45 in the morning, completely exhausted. Arguing with people that weren't there. That's not the swiftest way to live. And that's when I decided that I was going to not live that way anymore, and I start doing a step 11 every morning. And it tells you exactly how to run your day. It says, upon awakening. And it's a beautiful piece on page 86, 87, and 88. And I do it every morning. And I want to share something with you that happened with me one time when I was doing my reading. I told you that I grew up hating Catholics. And I want you to know that I have two beautiful daughters. One has been sober since 1966, just a beautiful gal. We gave Faye everything possible that she wanted. And you'll never believe what she did. She married a Catholic. No. An Italian one, the worst kind guy. I'm telling you. And she had a beautiful little daughter. I don't know where they got the beauty from, probably the Anglo-Saxon side of the family. And that little gal's name was Anna Louisa. And she was living down in eastern Canada, and I was coming back from maybe speaking somewhere in the south or somewhere, and I stopped to visit them, and little Anna was all packed, ready to come home with me. And naturally, she came home with me, because grandfather said that's what they're supposed to do. The next morning, I was in doing my reading, and she knocked on the door, and Babe said, "You can't go in there, honey. Gramps is doing his reading." And she said, "Well, I want to tell him something." And I said, "Let her come in." She came in. I took her up on my knee and told her what I was doing, and I said, "What do you want to tell me?" She said, "I want to tell you that I love you." And I said, "I want you to all love you too." And that may not mean a thing to anybody out there. But here's this old hard rock that came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't give love and I couldn't receive it. And here this little Catholic girl is telling me that she loves me. I'm telling her I love her too. She has a little sister. They're not little sisters anymore. Anna's in university, 21 years old. Chella is almost 19, also in university. Her name is Chella Maria. I don't know where they get the names. And Chella, everything that her grandfather says is gospel truth. She makes her mother just really angry. She'll say, "Well, Grandpa said that." Faye just walks away in disgust. And her and our buddies, she's going to work for me this summer. They have a Protestant cousin. His name is Jason. Some of you have met him. He comes to a lot of roundups with me, not because he's Protestant, but just because he's a guy, you know, and I like to bring along. And he went to Catholic school in high school. And then he came to tell me, "Do you know why I'm going there?" And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, they have a better spiritual program." Boy, oh boy, you know, I know what they mean by when they put those signs up, "Live and let live, keep an open mind," and, you know, all those things. Jason, the other night, I was at a beautiful night, and he's big in sea cadets. And he was the head guy in this big inspection they were having. He was given all the orders, and he's standing up there, and he won 3 great awards, big awards. And then he was asked by the powers to be that if he would go to university, he had refused to go to take an officer's training and be a regular Navy guy, but they told him that they want him to go because of all the awards he's received and be just an officer in the, you know, nighttime and things like that. But he'll be an officer, and I always wanted to be an officer, and so maybe he's going to be. And he'll get paid for that, and you know, what a beautiful thing, go to university. And he's pretty happy, and so am I. Donna got divorced from her Protestant husband. She too married an Italian Catholic. And they have a little guy. He's 7 years old. He's 8 years old. His name is Giovanni Anthony. Imagine that. How could they name a kid that? I call him Gio for short. And ever since he knew I didn't drink, he would bring a magazine and we'd sit and look at it, and he'd say, "Gio and Papa sees no way," when he'd look at a bottle of whiskey. He'd find cigarettes and he'd say, "Gio and Papa sees no way." And he went on when he was 4 years old, he went to a Catholic wedding, or Italian wedding down east, and when he came back, Donna said to him, "Tell Papa sees what you drank when you're down east," and he changed the subject. And finally they said, his daddy said, "Come on, tell Bob sees what you drank." And he said, "Well, I just had a little bit of wine." That's the only slip he's had. You know, he's all right. Had no drink since. And he and I are buddies. I'll tell you, we're buddies. We're really buddies. And it's just so great. All because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And people, you know, they wonder, they see me with my grandchildren, 4 of us out eating in a restaurant and having a great time. And I could have lost all of that. I could have lost it even in Alcoholics Anonymous. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have all of that. And believe me, it's wonderful. The 12th step said to me, having had a spiritual awakening, as the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Spiritual awakening to me is just personality change. When I got up the other morning at 3:30 in the morning, went into the bathroom, if I'd have said, holy malarkey, it's 3:30 in the morning, I have to drive 100 miles to Saskatoon, I have to catch a plane and go to Calgary, I have to change planes and I have to fly to California, ride up to a mountain somewhere, I'd have been played out before I got out of the bathroom, you know? But I'd done my reading. I call it 7 minutes with God. And I went into the bathroom and I'm in the mirror having a shave and thinking, boy, is it ever great. I'm going to California. I'm invited to go to California. And I'm going to see a lot of friends. I want to see Tom. Tom and I met Tom in 1963. Tom and I spoke at a young people's conference, I want you to know. Detroit, 1963. And we became friends then. 1965, Tom came to speak in our town. I introduced him to his wife. He took one of our nice ladies back to North Carolina. And I was down on his 35th anniversary not too long ago, January, speak at his 35th anniversary. I knew I was going to see Tom because I'm privileged to be his sponsor. And I knew that I was going to see Vinoy, and I was going to see Jim, and I was going to see Tracy, who I took to a meeting one time in Lubbock, Texas. And just a whole bunch of people I was going to see. And I drove off to Saskatoon feeling good, caught an airplane, fell asleep, and arrived here, and didn't sleep on the way up here, as a matter of fact. Sorry about that, Dave, but I didn't sleep. I always thought I would, but I didn't. And that's what it is with a personality change. That's all it is. Just doing the things you're just supposed to do each day and be happy about it and be comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to mention that to be comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous, because there's so many people just don't get comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they leave before they get comfortable. And if anybody is here who's a sponsor, please make sure that they do the steps. And if anybody's here that hasn't got a sponsor, find a sponsor that will make you do the steps. There are some musts in Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe they're not musts, but maybe there are else's. Whatever. And then it says, we tried to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. All we have to do is try. You know, I know tonight that some people in this room are suffering. Take a look at them. Look around tonight. You'll know the ones that are not, that got a football in their stomach because it shows in their face. Put your arm around them and tell them you want them, you need them, and love them. Show them the way and make them feel comfortable. Because they're entitled to that. Because it says we tried to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. Don't feel bad if they don't get comfortable. All you have to do is try. And then it says practice these principles in all our affairs. What principles are they talking about? I think they're talking about the principles we learned as we went through those steps. And it's pretty easy to be good and nice at a deal like this because the setting is just beautiful and everything is just fantastic. But what's going to happen when we leave here tomorrow? Suppose we're driving down that road and the winding trails there and your Al-Anon says, oh my God, I forgot my suitcase. That's when you practice principles. You finally find a place where you can turn around and you come back. And then you're heading for home again and you're trying to make up a little time and you get picked up for speeding and you mention the suitcase. That's when you practice the principles. Just before you arrive home, you run out of gas. That's when you practice the principles. You know, the principles are so easy. I want to share something with you that I was sharing with the fellows. My little Gio, he had his first communion a couple of weeks ago. And that's a big deal in the Catholic Church. And it was a big deal for me because he wanted me to be there. And I'd had a wisdom tooth taken out with a whole lot of gold in it because my brother's a dentist and we had all the gold there. And I had a nice little deal made for him with a cross on it. The little deal, you know, for the wine. I just wanted to show those Catholics that I knew what to do, you know. And Babe had given me a little brooch that she had with a diamond in it. And she said, maybe put that in. So I went home, and this diamond was in. I had this goldsmith do it. And I went home, and I didn't say, look what I've done. You know what I said? I said, Babe, without that diamond, this thing would be nothing. Happiest woman in the world. Just have to know what to say to them. Just lose the self-centeredness. And born it happy. I heard her telling her sister, she said, C said this deal is just really nice, but he said there'd be no good at all if that diamond wasn't in it, you know. She's happy for 7 days, you know. And it's no big deal. Just forget about yourself, what you did. And that's practicing the principles. I want you to know that I'm probably the most grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous in the whole wide world. Because I have so much, and so much has been so freely given to me, and I have friends all over the world. If ever I wanted to, I could go on a 5-year trip and freeload for 5 years. Because I don't know whether they meant it, but everybody says, come our way, stay a couple of weeks. I'm going to do that sometime. See whether they mean it. Whether they would practice principles. But isn't it wonderful that we, a bunch of people that came in here sick, we have principles. Isn't that a wonderful thing? And I want you to know that I am a lucky guy. And I want to thank the committee once again for giving me this very pleasurable privilege of being with you on a Saturday night. I want to thank you, the audience, because you're such a beautiful audience and you listened and you made things real easy for me. Last but not least, I want to thank God for giving me one more beautiful day to allow me to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, perhaps a purpose that I've been allowed to do and allowed to have in this beautiful fellowship. And there's a little town just outside of Omaha, Nebraska. It's a little town called Boys Town. And as you drive up to this little town, you see a statue. It's a statue of one little boy carrying another little boy. You can tell by the way he's stooped over and by the sweat on his brow that he's having a very difficult time. Underneath there are simple words, something like this. No, Lord, he is not heavy, for he is my brother. And I want to thank you people for being my brother and for being my sisters. And I want to leave this little thought with you, and I hope it'll help you as much as it helped me. You all look real good on the outside tonight. How are you really on the inside? Thank you, and God bless.